Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
All right, thank you, Bob. This is John Williams. So I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to do this right now, Bob Kessler. I want to talk to Andrea Darlis. I was talking to her before we went on the air, and she said, I'll be able to be there for you, but cell phone service when there are that many people in one place at one time can be spotty. Another friend of mine, Katie, is in Washington, D.C., and is at the rally there, and I'm having the same problem at this very moment connecting with her. So we'll see if we have either of them to join us in this half hour. Yeah, Griff, and if nothing else, Mark Lang is ready to roll, and he wrote George Bush's State of the Union address in 1991. You remember 1,000 points of light? That was him.
Who can forget?
I don't remember if we all thought that was terrific or balderdash. You know, is that? I mean, it was poetic, but what exactly did it mean? And maybe it didn't need to mean anything. My recollection is that when Mark Lang wrote for George Bush to say 1,000 points of light, that was my George Bush, that it didn't mean anything specifically. It was more an image or a feeling. And either that worked for you or it didn't. It always worked for me. I kind of like that imagery, and I'll internalize it and make it whatever I want to make it on my own. But he's a presidential speechwriter, and I talked to him yesterday about Donald Trump's State of the Union address, and he thought it was pretty dang good. Pardon me, State of the Union address, his inaugural address. And so I want to just play back part of that conversation for you. And then we'll sort of parcel in some of these correspondence, if you will, throughout the country today, because it's just such an amazing thing. Kathy O'Malley is somewhere in Chicago. Hey, Kathy O, thanks for calling in. How are you?
Hey, I'm fine, John. I'm back at the tower, but I walked down, when I got off the air, I walked down to Randolph, and then I followed this mass of people who are marching up Michigan Avenue, and you know how tough I am with crying, and that did it for me. It is the energy and the joy and it's really remarkable. I know I'm supposed to be a person of words. And
yeah, is that all you got for me, Kath? Really?
Yeah. I took pictures probably of about 100 signs. I'm going to post them on our page. I mean, it just speaks to the diversity of reasons that people were here. It's really remarkable. Really, really remarkable.
Well, I'm glad that you said that, Kathy, because Brenda is at the rally in St. Paul. My wife is. And Brenda's not a rally goer. Brenda's not a let's all go march and chant. She's never done that before.
Right.
And friends of hers all went down. And she texted me a little while ago from that rally where they say there's maybe 65,000 people. 65,000 people in St. Paul. And she said, it's just so positive. It feels so good. I don't know if they're chanting.
It's joyous.
Yeah. Well, that's
joyous. Yeah. Children, grandparents, dads with daughters. The range is just, you know, the range is huge, huge. And it's just,
but you know, here's a question I have for you, Kathy.
Yeah.
And by the way, to my producer, Griffin. Hey, Griff, I think if you call the number I gave you for Diane in Washington, D.C., we might be able to get through to Diane right now.
How many are there, John? How many in Washington?
I know that from the stage in Chicago, Kathy, they said it's 250,000, but I don't know if it is or not. I've seen the aerial shots from Washington, D.C., and I've heard everything from 250,000 to a million. I think the last number I saw from Washington Post was 400,000.
Oh my gosh!
Here's the thing, too, Kathy. I don't know. Maybe you can tell me what you sensed, but is it sort of an angry, snarky? Donald Trump, or is, because if it's not, then what is it?
There certainly was anti-Trump sentiment, posters for anti-Trump, but there were so many positive posters about women and their strengths and strength in numbers and stronger together. And I'm stepping out on Michigan Avenue now. There was some anti-Trump sentiment. Every now and again, you'd get, hey, hey, ho, ho, Donald Trump has got to go. But on the other hand, there were just positive, joyous messages of pride in being women and in human rights. I thought it was wonderful.
But, you know, you're almost sounding like one of those 99 percenters. We used to put those people on, and I could never tell exactly what their message was. And in this case,
Meaning what?
I mean, is this pro-women, or is it anti-Trump, or is it
civil rights? Both.
Yeah.
No, it's totally both pro-woman, anti-Trump, Black Lives Matter, Queer Nation. there was this whole huge contingent. I'm just looking now. Reproductive rights aren't up for grabs. A lot of representations of ovaries and fallopian tubes.
Well, the whole pussy thing really took off this week, and I was surprised to see that. I get it, and I understand it. I hadn't thought or talked about it for quite a while. We're talking about the Billy Bush tape surfaced, you know, right after the inauguration and or the nomination, and then that sort of thing got put on the back burner. But that seems to be fueling this series of rallies.
Right, a lot of hats. I'm not exactly sure what the hats. I mean, they're calling them pussy hats, but I don't get them because they don't look like any that I've ever seen.
On a phone line, stay here if you don't mind for just one more minute, Kathy.
No, O'Malley, not at all.
It's either Diane and or Katie are in Washington D.C. Who's on this other line now? Diane, is that you? Yeah. That's the gargled phone line from Diane Alexander in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way it's going to be for anybody trying to get out of some of those large groups. Diane, can you hear us?
I can hear you, John, yes, for the moment.
Oh, good, Diane.
I can hear you.
Hey, listen, talk away for just a minute, if you can, Diane, and tell us what you're seeing and why you're there.
Oh, I guess, you know, why I'm here first, like many people, you know, just feeling despair about what's happened in the election, very much a big supporter of President Obama and Hillary Clinton, and so was very disappointed in the election outcome. And I feel...
Yeah, I know. She's still on, but it's chopping in and out. Griff, why don't you put her back on hold, and if we can get a better cell for her, like, you know, in a week, maybe we'll put her back on. Kathy, are you still there by any chance?
Yeah, right. Love Not Hate makes America great. That's a sign that's just walking by now. And then there's Not My President sign. So, I mean, it's a whole range.
Are you surprised by the volume of these rallies, Kathy?
Yes, I am. I thought it would be really cool if 20,000 people showed up, and apparently there's about 150,000. So, yeah. And I would like that. I would like to think that momentum can hold, that people will continue to be aware and vigilant. I think vigilant is important, and be willing to speak out when they think when bad stuff's happening.
You know, when you were just now searching for the word that came to my mind was vigilant, because I don't want to be obstructionist. If Donald Trump can make America greater than it was, and this Congress works with him and it all goes swell, why would we want to be in the way? But there's a trust factor there right now. And so
absolutely,
I think if people are vigilant, and this is just a visual to the current Congress and the president that we're not going to go easy. We're going to pay attention. Yeah, right. Then,
right.
You know, do your job. Go be a good president. Try not to get in war with China, but know that we're paying attention.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Oh, well.
All right, Kathy O'Malley. Nice to hear your voice. Hey, thanks for calling
time.
In. Yeah.
Take care, John. Love you.
How about that? Kathy O'Malley saying hi, and I sure appreciate that. So there she goes. And let's take our break here. I suspect I'm not going to be able to connect to our friends in Washington, D.C. just now. And I do have the guy that wrote George Bush's speech, and he has something interesting to say about Donald Trump's address, and he thought it was pretty good. And that's coming up here on WGN. Our Mincing Rascals podcast we cut on Thursday of this week, and we always broadcast part of that on Saturdays. After the 1:30 news, we'll be getting to Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie from the Tribune and our own Steve Bertrand in just a little bit. And then maybe yes, maybe no, but I'll tell you this book by Lisa Napoli about Ray and Joan Kroc, the man who made the McDonald's fortune and the woman who gave it all away, is timely and really fascinating, especially with the Michael Keaton movie coming out this week called The Founder about McDonald's. But before we do any of that, let's have part of a conversation here with Mark Lang. In 1991, he was the co-writer, if you will, of George Bush's State of the Union address. He's the one who coined the term 1,000 points of light. And this is part of my conversation with him from yesterday after Donald Trump's speech.
I am well, John, and happy to be with you.
I went back and have been reading your speech today. We have within our reach the promise of a renewed America. Is that you?
Well, you know what? Speechwriters are supposed to be heard and not seen, so it wouldn't be the best policy for me to take credit for a single word. But obviously there are people who stare at blinking cursors all day and come up with phrases, and that would have been one of mine.
We can find meaning and reward by serving some higher purpose than ourselves, a shining purpose, the illumination of 1,000 points of light. And it's expressed by all who know the irresistible force of a child's hand, of a friend who stands by you and stays there, a volunteer's generous gesture, an idea that is simply right. Oh, that's good stuff, Mark. If you had anything to do with that, well done, sir.
Well, that's generous. You know, ultimately, the principal, the man at the microphone, and someday the woman at the microphone, is really responsible for all of the feeling that ultimately shows up in the words. You're a transcriptionist in a lot of ways.
How often do presidents write State of the Unions or inauguration speeches? Do you have a sense of how that normally works?
You know, I think it varies quite a bit based on the disposition and nature of the president who's in place. There are some, like Obama and Clinton, who were very involved in drafting and drafted a lot of their own stuff. Obama was famous for filling up yellow pads with an awful lot of language that ultimately became part of his addresses. And then there are others who are a little less engaged in the specific wordsmithing, but who are very focused on getting the ideas right.
And ultimately, they're the editor. So if you or somebody wrote something that they didn't agree with or they just didn't like the cadence of it, then they would edit it or have you change it, right?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting, and that also varies by administration. President H.W. Bush was very certain about what fit him, you know, like a good suit or an ill-fitting suit. And if you tried, in his case, to reach too hard, if the rhetorical flourishes became too Churchillian, as was a risk during the Gulf War and during the fall of the Berlin Wall, he would write, "Not me," in the margin, right? So they have ultimate veto power.
My colleague and I here were talking about, we both, like most Americans, heard and or read the speech. I thought it sounded very much like Donald Trump and believe he wrote it. What's your guess on that, Mark?
You know, you could sense his DNA and fingerprints all over it. I suspect he was quite involved line by line in the drafting of that. And at the same time, there are rhetorical reaches in there that are very poetic. And, you know, as talented as he is as a rhetorician, I've got to believe there were writers who were helping him out there.
What line stood out to you? I mean, if there was one, they'll remember. What was his 1,000 points of light today?
You know, I think there were many. It was really well done. When he said, "This is your day, this is your celebration, and this, the United States of America, is your country," I thought that was really quite beautiful. There were other lines. He talks about the oath of office I take today as an oath of allegiance to all Americans. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather let it shine as an example. We will shine for everyone to follow. That was very much in the tradition of the shining city on a hill that President Reagan talked about.
There was one line that stood out to me. Now arrives the hour of action. Because, you know, he's not been content with the status quo. I felt it was an angry speech. And so he's like, this ain't good enough that I got here. He's still ticked. He's still running for office and wants to make America great again. And I thought that line neatly represented what he's been trying to say and do. Now arrives our hour of action.
It's a great line, and it also points to a total paradox, right, in this as well as any other inaugural address, because every president will say something along the lines of, we need to move beyond rhetoric. But, of course, they're using rhetoric.
My view, and I'll just say this to get your reaction, Mark, but I told you I thought it was angry, and I didn't feel included in it. Mm-hmm. I felt I didn't vote for Donald Trump, and I've been critical of him on this show. So maybe I can't be a fair listener to it, but I just thought it was mean-spirited and did not welcome me into the tent. How do you feel about that, and what should I do to better appreciate what he said?
Leadership in general is, if I were to generalize, is this process of reciprocal sense-making, right? And every speech is like a Rorschach blot, and it's drafted in a way that you hope people are projecting their own hopes into it and their own aspirations into it. And there were passages in this address that were very conciliatory and were attempting to unify, but then there were a lot that painted an extraordinarily dark picture of this country, full of internal contradictions and actual misstatements of fact.
Yeah, right.
Which were very troubling, and no brilliant rhetoric, but nothing on how we're going to bring back our jobs, bring back our borders,
right,
bring back our wealth, bring back our dreams. And the one policy statement he made was, we'll follow two simple rules, buy American and hire American, which are among the most unrealistic goals you could possibly set from a policy standpoint. We've been filling our homes with cheaper goods from China and shuttering factories, and that's been a consumer choice for years.
Let me ask you a couple of specific things that he also raised, and tell me if you feel like that was a good idea or bad. He specifically called out radical Muslim terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
He almost relished using that phrase. The past administration would not use those words together. Was that wise for him to say that literally in this speech?
You know, in so many speeches, there is something known as red meat that you toss to your base. And he's speaking to his base there. He's not speaking to those who didn't vote for him. And you make a calculation every time you do that, that the alignment you drive with your core supporters is more important on whatever dimension you're raising.
That's so sad, Mark. The people that voted for you got you there, but now he's my president. More people mm-hmm. voted for Hillary than for him, and he mm-hmm. has to be a president for all of us. So the red meat for the, minority of people who voted for him, mm-hmm. I think is disenfranchising to the rest of us. And this is where he needs to hold his hand out.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really very legitimate concern. I also think that he taps into a level of cynicism that is unfortunate. It doesn't appeal to the better angels of anyone's nature. It was not a conciliatory, inclusive address by any stretch. I think, there were places where he was making a rhetorical effort, but he was speaking to the people that elected him.
Mark Lang wrote the State of the Union address for President Bush 41 in 1991. He also called out the politicians of both political stripes, many of whom were sitting on stage with him, one of whom he'd just had tea with, and he painted a picture of them as taking advantage of their position rather than working for the good of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
How did you hear that?
It's very hard to be in politics and policy these days, and what Mr. Trump didn't do in any way was appeal to the ideal of public service. And I think millennials need to hear that. People growing up, in an earlier stage of life need to understand that there is an idealism behind public service. And that's something that other presidents have invoked, and that Donald Trump is, he's still running against government as if he's running for office.
The winds of change are with us now. The forces of freedom are together united. We move toward the next century more confident than ever that we have the will at home and abroad to do what must be done, the hard work of freedom. I guess if he had said something like that, which you wrote for President Bush, it would have seemed, however beautiful, phony's not the right word, but not him, right, Mark? I mean, it would be wrong maybe for him to speak that way.
Well, it's back to the suit fitting, right?
Yeah.
It's got people, Americans have a really good gimlet eye for somebody who's putting on airs and putting on words that don't suit them.
But no, make no mistake about it, Mark Lang, who wrote George Bush's 1991 State of the Union address, he coined that phrase, 1,000 points of light, like the speech. He thought there were not only rhetorical flourishes, but you get the sense that he's behind the message underneath them, too. Nice guy. I sure appreciated him coming on and giving us his informed perspective on that. Speaking of which, the Mincing Rascals, our weekly podcast, we broadcast part of on Saturdays. And the roundtable has some things to say about the incoming administration appointees. And there's no agreement there. yesterday was such a thrilling day for so many people. They saw the new first family. They saw the new president speak and vice president. And then the balls and the galas and the parade and the pomp and the ceremony. And some people loved the speech that he gave. And for half the population, Bob, yesterday was the day they'll always remember. and other people felt quite differently. I think that other half of the population feels like today is a day they'll always remember. Yesterday they were sad, and today they got goosebumps when they hear these reports of the populations that are showing up in not just St. Paul and Washington, D.C., and Chicago and Los Angeles, but in Sydney, in Europe, all around the world. Millions of people are rallying. I'm not exactly clear what the message is, but clearly they, I don't know that it's entirely fair to say it's anti-Trump, but it's obviously all around that. And I think a lot of people today are going to remember this as the great day they felt really good. And the other half of the population that felt great yesterday, today is going to remember this day as a day where they felt quite angry. And that is what it is. We sat down with our Mincing Rascals podcast group. That's Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune and Kristen McQuarey, who is one of the columnists and editorial writers at the Chicago Tribune, and our own Steve Bertram. We post these podcasts on Thursdays now. It used to be on Friday the day we'd drop it, but we did it on Thursday. So this was just in advance of Donald Trump's big speech. But the gang wasn't so interested in his coming speech as they were in some of his political appointments and the transition of power.
I always get a little emotional when there's any sort of a turning of the page. So, you know, I am sorry to see him go. I think the crescendo building up to the election I thought might have fizzled, but it hasn't. I mean, it is still just a very heated environment that Trump is coming into. And it concerns me a little bit that we are so divided and that there's just no room for him. Nobody's willing to even give him a chance, it feels.
Oh,
so I'm concerned about
that. I'm sorry. I disagree. I mean, I think people were willing, maybe if not to give him a chance, to at least dial down the rhetoric. And he is the man singularly who's burned up his own sort of honeymoon.
I'm thinking more of the nomination hearings. I've been watching a lot of them, of his cabinet members this week. And the snide remarks and the effort to try to discredit some of these folks who are going before the nomination committee in a way that just has not been done before with other cabinet appointments.
What do you mean?
Some of the comments and questions to Betsy DeVos were just snarky and tried to undercut her and make her seem like a housewife who didn't belong in that chair. And there have been some others. I mean, we were trading emails about some of the questions of their investments and it's a much deeper dive than you saw with somebody like Penny Pritzker, who also was heir to a fortune and was Obama's choice for Commerce Secretary after two previous Commerce Secretaries didn't get support.
But Zoe Baird was torpedoed because she had not paid taxes for a nanny. She wanted to be Attorney General, good or bad. And this guy Price, Congressman Price, is buying drug company stocks and then introducing a week later legislation that will impact them. I think that's pretty serious. It seems pretty serious.
It is, and it's worth it. I'm not saying the question shouldn't be asked. It's just in the context of what the Senate and members of Congress do in there. If they file paperwork, you can look it up. It's public record where all of their investments are, and they get caught all the time doing questionable things, voting on things that help their stock, or this wife all of a sudden bought a bunch of. So I'm not saying it's right. I'm just trying to provide some context that I haven't seen other cabinet members get the same sort of scrutiny.
But this was a particularly provocative set of nominees, I think. I mean, you look at Ben Carson, really, for HUD? I mean, come on.
Rick Perry
for energy. Want
to get rid of it?
Betsy DeVos, and I know, Kristen, you think highly of her, but she is way out there on the fringe. She does not believe, basically, in public education.
That is just not true, Eric. It's just that
she wants to privatize the whole thing.
I'm sure you're reading your Twitter feed that feeds this impression of her. I'm not even saying I think highly of Betsy DeVos. I like that he's choosing people who are outside of the establishment, and she is one of them.
Down the line, he has made a series of very provocative cabinet appointments. I mean, there are not a lot of people. The guy who's in charge of the environment doesn't believe in climate change. I mean, he's suing the EPA.
That's not true, Eric. He said this week during the hearings that he does.
He did say that this week.
Oh, he did? Okay, he's changed his tune.
I'm a little encouraged by what I'm hearing from the hearings.
Oh, you're going to have to wait a minute then.
Go ahead, Steve Bertram.
Kristen, I kind of agree with you. I mean, I think that these nominees, I think there are real questions about them. I think it's fascinating that you have the nominees for Defense Secretary and Secretary of State testifying that they are diametrically opposed to the stated position of the man they're going to work for. That's amazing to me. But when it comes, when it all shakes down, they're all going to get approval, and the Democrats are going to ask their pointed questions or snide questions to make their mark. What's kind of remarkable to me is, I think I agree with both of you, Eric, they're incredibly provocative. There are some of them who, you know, their credentials are questionable, especially Perry and Energy. But I think that because there's a much bigger question mark than a cabinet secretary, I mean, that Donald Trump is, that none of these little sorts of fight, there's a much bigger fish in the pan, that all this other stuff is just going to go through. It's just going to go through the motions and everyone's going to be approved.
I don't know. I mean, Obama didn't get all of his approvals. He tried to nominate Tom Daschle, who in the time that he left the Senate and the time he was nominated for HHS secretary had done some lobbying and was not approved.
Right. So, he was kind of sunk on a tax technicality-ish.
But his driver, wasn't it? He wasn't paying taxes on his...
Yeah, those were sinkable 16 years ago or 8 years ago. And now, and to Trump's credit, he's got the power. He's got the boldness. I can just say, just screw it. It doesn't matter. You know, these people are going through anyway, and they are going to go through.
I think they
anyway.
Haven't been proper. A lot of them have not been vetted, like a Tom Daschle or someone who's been in public service. So I understand the complaints that some of them didn't fill out their ethics forms completely. But I just think, you know, the fact that when it came to Betsy DeVos, you know, yes, she has wealth. Absolutely. No, she doesn't have a lot of experience with Pell Grants. No, her kids didn't have to take out loans to go to college. But kind of putting her on the spot and trying to embarrass her for her wealth, which she has used in a way that a lot of people think is admirable to try to push an issue she feels very strongly about in her own state. And when she's testifying before members of Congress who themselves went to private school, send their kids to private school. Yet
she was also asked by the Connecticut senator whether or not guns should be allowed in school, and she couldn't say no.
Her first answer was, I agree with, that it should be up to states and local governments, because you can't say what's a local school board in Texas thinks about, you know, concealed carry versus a school in Chicago. But then she made an absolutely asinine comparison
about
the grizzly bear. But she started off okay, but then right.
You can say it's up to states and local governments, but I think no. You know what I mean?
Well,
you can say both.
I don't. I'm very much in that states and local governments should be in charge of making those kinds of decisions.
I'm saying
that's
you can say both
opinion,
things. You
Steve.
Can say,
I
no,
mean,
no.
You're assuming that that's the right answer. She can be for arming somebody in a school.
But even the question, I mean, some of these questions were meant to put her on the spot. They didn't even let her complete a lot of the questions they asked her, and it was more about letting Tim Kaine and Elizabeth Warren and some of these other people have a little soapbox when they themselves are not supported. If you consider that they themselves have sent their kids to private school or they went to private school, they're not accessing the public education system, but they want to flame her for supporting charter schools.
The thing is, though, that it's not who the U.S. Secretary of Education isn't all that important, really. It's all going to be what the Trump administration wants. Can anyone name the current Secretary of Education?
Please be quiet. Arnie's back in town. He doesn't want to hear that.
He's not. I mean, it's not. It's John King. And I had to look it up on my phone because I didn't even know that. I mean, the truth is, I mean, I guess in some ways I would say that a president is entitled to surround himself with a cabinet that he wants and try to push things through. I'm hoping that I see some Republicans getting up on their hind legs and standing up to Trump on something. You know, it is important that you have some check and balance, that you don't have the Senate just going, whatever you want, Mr. Trump.
I think we're going to find out how important these secretary positions are, right? I mean, this whole process, Kristen's right, it's always the other side sniping and using it as a soapbox to either run the person down or espouse their own views. But generally, they get approved, and generally, they then do something. Sometimes it's a figurehead. I'm not sure that Ray LaHood was an expert on transportation, but he was the transportation secretary. There weren't that many highways in Peoria, for crying out loud. I don't know how important that is.
There are more now.
Yeah, I'm sure one named after him.
Right. They've got four airports now and nine train stations. Right.
LaHood Airport number one, LaHood Airport number two.
Yeah, but I do want to. I'm looking more for a broader trend. Are they going to stay? Is the Republican majority in the Senate going to stand up to him in some ways?
I think they will. I absolutely do, Eric. I mean, you see this in the nomination process as it is now. Donald Trump has no interest in the one China policy, but don't you think the U.S. Senate and the Congress and maybe some of the people behind him who he doesn't even know yet will say, you know, we need to be more measured about this?
But here's the problem, John, and I think I've said this before. I don't know which of the words coming from the administration matter? Or, and I think none of them, I don't think any is definitive. That's my issue. So when you have the president-elect giving an interview overseas saying again that NATO is obsolete.
Yeah, well, he doesn't know what that means.
I don't care, because then you have his proposed Secretary of Defense saying, if we didn't have NATO now, we'd have to create it. Okay, which of those words matter?
Let's look at his Twitter account, shall we? And that is where the John Lewis debate sort of really erupted. Oh.
John Lewis is an American hero and an icon, and every member of Congress should be standing there to see the next president take the oath. Absolutely.
Kristen, are you the same way on that?
I just think it's kind of rude. In the same way that congressman yelled out liar to Obama, which was really, really offensive. But I also respect their First Amendment right to not go. There were Republicans, a handful of them, maybe 20, who didn't go to Obama's. And they instead went out to California and rented a nice house, and they joked about how they were going to sit in the hot tub.
I don't remember that. There were maybe,
well, of course there was... not, because nobody made a big freaking deal about it.
Including Obama. There's a couple of dozen people, though, who did not go to Obama's inauguration.
Oh, yeah, many.
That fact is lost on me this
week.
I'll
send you the
link. I'm not arguing you. I'm glad you brought that up. What do you think about all that?
I agree with Steve. I mean, I think that you should go, because you're not celebrating Donald Trump. You're celebrating the orderly transition of power.
On the eve of Martin Luther King Day,
he picks
a fight with John Lewis.
I know. Well, John Lewis picked a fight with him by calling him an illegitimate president. But, but you know what? I like Michelle Obama's advice. When people go low, you go high. And Trump could have just ignored it, said nothing, not picked on a civil rights leader.
What do you think he meant by that, Kristen? What did he mean by illegitimate president? Do you think he's saying that they literally rigged the election, the numbers weren't legitimate, and that maybe Hillary in fact won? Or is he just saying emails were released and it made it harder for Hillary to win? If that's the case, that doesn't make him an illegitimate president. It makes him the president. He's the president.
It's a silly argument. He's the legitimate president. And
thank you.
Especially when you're the incoming president of the United States, you put out a statement saying, I respect John Lewis and all that he's done. I respectfully disagree with him on this point, and I wish him well.
You don't say anything.
Can you imagine if Barack Obama or George W. or any previous president had responded to every time he was criticized on TV by an actress?
What's our thought about the march then? The rallies will number tens of thousands.
It's a statement of solidarity and purpose. I think I'm all for it. I think it's a great thing. Mary Schmeek has a wonderful column about why it's a good thing to go. I'm generally a little bit leery of protests that don't have a particular message or an ask. Like, what is it that they want to have happen? But I think it's just people getting together and saying, look, we're all here, we're all watching, we're all ready to mobilize when issues take place. I think it's a wonderful thing.
Right. Yeah, can somebody explain why it smells like hamburgers in the studio right now? I'm so hungry.
It's a Christmas cologne I was given.
To smell like Burger King?
Working.
Ladies, go for it.
It's very attractive, Steve.
It's called Portillo.
It's very hot.
Oh, Steve, I have
made right.
Steve Bertrand's nickname is Big Mac, if you need to know. By the way, speaking of Big Macs, we'll try and connect with Lisa Napoli, who wrote the story of Ray Kroc, his wife Joan, and the McDonald's franchise empire, and that'll be after 2 o'clock. Speaking of the rallies, though, and thanks again to our mincing rascals, that Steve Bertrand, Kristen McQueary, and Eric Zorn, Bertrand from GN, the rest of them from the Chicago Tribune, of course, and that full podcast is available online. You can hear it at WGN.com or just subscribe to it, The Mincing Rascals, wherever you subscribe to your fine podcasts. Hey, we may connect with Andrea Ellis. She's at the Chicago rally. That's next on WGN. By the way, if you were at one of those rallies, I was so clever. I arranged to talk to people at rallies across the country, but because of the size of them, it's hard for cell signals to get out. And so every time we've been reaching somebody in one of these cities, we can't put them on the air. It's too garbled. But maybe you're out of the throng and you can call in and tell us what it was like. Or maybe you have a friend or family member that's there. In fact, hey, Griff, Julie is ready to go right now. I'm going to read this commercial after I talk to Julie, because I don't want to lose her if I can get her. Hey, Julie, this is John and you're on WGN. How are you? I'm going to keep trying, though. Hey, Julie, are you there? Speak to me.
I'm here.
Okay, good. Where are you, Julie?
We're about 3 blocks away from the Capitol, heading down toward the White House, just right in the middle of the march.
And, Julie, we haven't met before, but we have a mutual friend. Tell me a little bit about yourself. Who are you? What do you do?
I am a pediatric nurse practitioner. I am the mother of two teenage daughters and a teenage son.
And you are in Washington, D.C. right now. You are originally from Minnesota. You flew out there today, right?
Yes. We went right to our hotel and just walked over to the march, which is ongoing. There's people just absolutely everywhere. All varieties of signs and chants, and it's very, very peaceful, though very, very crowded.
Where are you in relation to the Capitol? Are you near the National Mall where the, say, president gave his inaugural speech and so forth?
I love that. So if I turn around and look, the Capitol is about five blocks directly behind me.
And just give me a sense of the crowd, though. We're looking at it overhead on CNN and other networks today, but can you tell me a little bit about how you're getting around and how big the crowd is?
So right now we're actually marching in the street, and the street is full, edge to edge, wall to wall. There are people in various businesses set up on bleachers, cheering, some at intersections. But there's people absolutely everywhere.
Are you getting any pushback? Or are there some people booing the crowd? Do you sense any hostility at you?
Not at all. We walked past one set of counter protesters that said "bikers for Trump," but as the women's marchers walked past them, we drowned them out with our cheers. But there was nothing animosic about it. The police came through with about five or six cars. Up ahead of us, but the crowd just parted quietly and applauded them as they went through. It was wonderful to see.
Julie, one last question for you, then I'll let you go. But why are you marching today?
Well, a lot of it is to keep alive the idealism of my children and my daughters, and feeling at my very core complete an utter disconnect from the values that have been brought forth and espoused by our new administration.
Well, I can hear the crowd in the background, Julie. Thank you for joining us today. We'll perhaps visit later on, but thanks for picking up the phone. That's Julie Keeney, and she is from Minneapolis-St. Paul. She flew this morning to Washington, D.C. to be part of that rally. I'll tell you what, though, the Chicago rally is getting as much attention as any of them in the country today. Andrea Darlis is there from the WGN Radio Newsroom, and maybe we can connect with Andrea. Andrea, are you there?
John, yeah, I am actually at the entrance and the exit of where the rally was today, right on Columbus and Monroe. And from the beginning, John, it was peaceful and calm and orderly. Everybody walked us through the security area quickly and, again, very orderly. And when I first got here earlier this morning, they said, well, we're hoping between 25 and maybe 50,000. Then Lyle Dean's daughter, Kirsten Whipple, is one of the march organizers, one of the spokeswomen. So I kept talking to her, and she's like, Andrea, it's up to 100,000. It's up to 150. By the last time I interviewed her, their numbers were 250,000 people.
Hmm. Andrea, you've covered all of the big rallies in Chicago when the Blackhawks won, when the White Sox won.
Yeah.
Can you kind of compare or contrast it in size?
You know, that's a really, really good question. The Cubs rally was unbelievable. You know, you had a million people here. But, again, it was orderly and calm. That's what I really have to give props to the city of Chicago for. You know, when we have these rallies and demonstrations, it's calm and it's peaceful. And that's what it was today on a much smaller level. You know, we were number two in the country, only second to Washington, D.C. for this rally. And it was calm and peaceful. And I'm really kind of, you know, there's a part of me being a Chicagoan and a reporter that we're proud to have Lisa Madigan was here and Tony Preckwinkle was here. And
Tammy Duckworth. I saw Tammy Duckworth, although I think Tammy was actually rallying in Washington, D.C. But
But it's so nice to get a turnout.
And now she cuts out. All right, that's our Andrea Darlis, who is over by Grant Park. Bob, I'm about to talk to Lisa Napoli about her book, Ray and Joan, about the McDonald's fortune and the lady that gave it away. But did you see the news this week that McDonald's is coming out with two new versions of the Big Mac?
That one I did miss.
That wasn't your lead?
It wasn't my lead.
Any newscast this week?
There's going to
be
a
Mac, a Mac Junior, which will be smaller, and then a Mac, like a Grand Mac, which will be a bigger version of the Big Mac, and they'll both have the special sauce. At this time, could you sing for us, Bob, the Big Mac jingle?
Was it? I don't know if the melody goes to All Beef Patty Special Sauce, Lettuce, Cheese, Pickles, Onions, on a sesame seed bun. But I don't know how you could sing it.
To All Beef Patty Special Sauce, Lettuce, Cheese, Pickles, Onions on a Sesame Seed Bun. Yeah. Lisa Napoli joins us now. Her book is Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. Hi, Lisa. This is John Williams. You're on WGN.
Thanks for having me. I hope you're not going to make me sing that song.
I'll bet you knew it, though.
I did. It's part of the research.
I was going to say, you're too young to have actually grown up with that song, but there was a time when a Big Mac was a very exciting thing for the population. That was really, I'm not kidding. A Big Mac was a big deal for people once upon a time.
I'm not laughing at that. I'm laughing that I'm too young. I do remember it well. Absolutely. We used to sing it all the time. Absolutely.
How did this story get on your radar? What attracted you to the Croc story?
Well, it wasn't because of the Big Mac, because I don't eat Big Macs, but it was because of Joan. And Joan is an amazing woman, an incredible philanthropist who really never got her due. And to me, you know, you couldn't tell her story unless you told Ray's story, and you couldn't tell Ray's story unless you told the McDonald's story. But it was all because of a sculpture she funded in Southern California, not far from where I lived, that was in disrepair, that it turns out she anonymously funded about 20 years ago. And when I heard about that, it made me curious, and there was no biography of her, so I set about writing one.
So I've read the book. One of the things that jumps out at me early on is that when her husband Ray, you know, took off with McDonald's, he was in his 50s. I mean, it's not like he was some whippersnap who grew up with this idea. It wasn't his restaurant at first, and he didn't become attracted to it until really the second half of his career.
Yeah. His first wife wanted him to retire because he was getting older, and he just was so taken by the idea when he discovered it in the desert of Southern California that he ran with it. Yeah. And he was, of course, based in Chicago on 221 North LaSalle Drive, where he was selling milkshake machine mixers. But this hamburger stand in the desert just captivated him, and he knew that it was something that most of America would love. I don't think he had any idea. I'm sure he had no idea just how big it would get, though.
So was that the connection? He tried to sell the original McDonald's restaurant, the milkshake machine, and that's when he found out about the restaurant and how it worked?
They actually placed an order for a number of them. There were all of these roadside hamburger stands developing all around the nation at that time, in the 50s, late 40s, early 50s. And this one restaurant bought so many of the milkshake machine mixers that Ray's interest peaked, because he couldn't understand. They were multi-spindled, so they allowed you to make six at a time. And he couldn't understand why one little joint in San Bernardino, California, would need so many of these machines. So we went to check it out. And that's when he saw that they were different than the other restaurants. There were no car hops. They were very precise and meticulous, and they had this assembly line system for making a hamburger, and that completely captivated him. So that's basically how it all came to be.
So if in my mind Ray Kroc was the guy that invented that system, he didn't. Somebody else had already cooked it up. He saw it. What was his genius then? Why did he become Mr. McDonald's?
Good question. And for many years, McDonald's wanted you to think that he was the guy who was behind McDonald's, but it really was two brothers named McDonald who had come out west in the early part of the century to make it in the movie business. And they were not able to make it in the movie business, so they started a little stand. At that time, all these stands were developing. They were a great, easy way to get into being an entrepreneur and didn't require that much startup. And Ray just wrested control of the business because the brothers really didn't care about taking it public or taking it wide. Certainly, they didn't think about taking it public. And even Ray was kind of reluctant about it. But the idea was that the brothers were working hard, like anybody in the restaurant business does, and they were making a good buck. They were buying themselves new Cadillacs every year. But they didn't have the desire to work like the maniac that you have to work to get something national. And, you know, it's hard. They didn't invent McDonald's. A lot of people think that McDonald's invented franchising, and certainly Ray Kroc didn't, nor did McDonald's. But the idea that you would get consistent food from city to city was something that was just becoming appealing back then because we were becoming more mobile as a culture. And the brothers knew that to do that, you'd have to hunt. You'd have to go from city to city and police the standards of each place to make sure that the thing that they created was consistent. And they didn't want to be bothered. But Ray did. He'd been a traveling salesman all his life. So for him, that was just a natural extension of what he did. He was a workaholic from the get-go. And back when he was selling paper cups to Wrigley Field, as a young man and playing piano at the Oak Park Arms Hotel, at one of the first radio stations in the country, he always had two jobs. So for him, the idea of running around the country and setting up McDonald's was pure joy.
Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of work, a lot of detail, but he was up to the task. Talk a little bit more about his personality. He was not only meticulous, he wanted you to pick up the garbage in the parking lot every single hour. What was he like?
Well, you know, that is a sort of sums him up. He wasn't mercurial and meticulous. He was very competitive. He was famous for saying, if my competition was drowning, I put a hose in their mouth. So he was a ruthless businessman, and he, you know, came by it honestly. He'd been a traveling salesman for so many years, and he knew all the tricks of trade. But he also, because he'd been on the road for so many years and going into drugstores, soda fountain counters, and these roadside stands, he knew what it took to make a restaurant good. And he saw that there were a lot of schlocky operations out there. They weren't clean. The bathrooms weren't clean. The employees were kind of disinterested in what was going on. I can't even imagine what Ray Kroc would think about employees texting behind the cash register now. But yeah. He saw bad service, and he knew that good service would be something that would dazzle a customer and get them to come back. And that was the difference in that moment in time is that, you know, he didn't want it just in one store. He wanted you to think, oh, okay, I see this brand. I know it's good. If I go into it in Iowa, it's going to be just as good, just as delicious, just as clean, and just as reliable. And back then, the food was all locally sourced and made to a sort of recipe or prescription that Ray was selling people. So that was an interesting difference from back then till now, and it was difficult for him to keep the food consistent because, of course, unless it's all trucked in on a refrigerated truck, it's hard to make sure your milkshake is the same as mine. So,
yeah, right,
had a lot of challenges.
Well, you know, your description of the precision with which he wanted the restaurants run and the cleanliness and the attention to detail and consistency of the menu in every restaurant, no matter where you went, reminds me of another McDonald's jingle. Grab a bucket and mop. Scrub the bottom and top. There is nothing so clean as my burger machine. You deserve a break today, so get up and get away to McDonald's. And in that commercial, it was a bunch of guys who were almost Broadway-style singing and dancing, but it was all men.
Yes.
They were perfectly scrubbed with white teeth. If there was an African-American in that commercial, I don't remember it. And they were, you know, they were telling you about how pristine the restaurant was as much as how good the food was. I suspect now, yes, knowing what I do, that was really a reflection of the owner.
Well, exactly, and also a reflection of the time, because we were getting used to, as a culture, going into a brand name place. You know, there was a time that you wouldn't, it's not even that you wouldn't want to go into a brand name place, it just didn't exist. And so he needed to convince you that the standards were consistent, and that's one way he did it, because he knew that cleanliness was in short supply in a lot of places. So, and that is a good point, too, to point out that women were not allowed to work in the very first restaurants.
Yeah, I read, I was kind of slack-jawed when I saw that. He did not allow women to work in the front and really didn't want them there at all. And I thought, wait a minute, I know that's against the law now. So
right.
How did he get away with that? But I guess it wasn't against the law then.
You look at the want ads back then, and they were divvied up, ladies and gents. That's how want ads were
oh, really?
Back then.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. Not that long ago, you could specify certain sort of physical abilities too. Yeah, not very long ago. That's why, you know, you've got all those women marching in the streets today in Chicago, because some of them remember that things used to be very different.
Lisa Napoli's on the line. Her book is Ray and Joan, the man who made the McDonald's fortune and the woman who gave it all away. Okay, she didn't give it all away, but I mean, well, I guess she did. So the Joan half of the story, where the two of them intersect, is fascinating also. Let's pause here and pick it up there. Lisa Napoli on the line. Her book is a Dutton hardcover, and it coincides nicely with the Michael Keaton movie about the same subject. We'll talk about that, too, in a minute here on WGN.
I am flesh and I am bone. Rise up, ting, ting, like glitter and gold.
How can we be almost out of capital?
Did you mortgage our home?
Maybe we could lose everything.
I want to renegotiate my lousy deal.
I can't.
Can't or won't?
Ray.
What?
No!
Oh, damn it.
What you ought to be doing is owning the land upon which that burger is cooked. You're not in the burger business. You're in the real estate business.
Franchise Realty Corporation.
It's its own separate company, which puts it outside your purview.
There's a wolf in the hen house. We let him in.
When's enough going to be enough for you?
Probably never.
You are to stop this instant.
I am through taking orders from you.
You have a contract.
Contracts are like hearts. They're made to be broken.
He got himself another good one. The founder, he plays Ray Kroc in that movie. And on a line is Lisa Napoli, who wrote about the same story. Ray and Joan is her book. It's just out. Is he that ruthless? I mean, we get the sense from at least that, Lisa, that he sort of wrestled control of McDonald's away from the McDonald's brothers. Is that your read on it, too?
It is true. I mean, they kind of wanted to go away by the end of it because they were tired of him. He was not a nice guy. He was either super charming if he loved you and needed you and you loved him, or not.
And did the fortune get made because of the real estate? It wasn't the burgers. It was that they owned the land. How is that so critical?
Well, that's what's so interesting about it. And even Ray said later in his life that it wasn't he who came up with the formula. It wasn't the hamburgers that made it happen for McDonald's. It was this guy, Harry Sonneborn, who came along and worked with Ray and helped him create this formula where they bought the land on which all of the McDonald's were built in the early days of the franchises. Suburbs were developing all over. That was critical and key. And that's why McDonald's was able to be the first fast food restaurant that went public in 1965. You know, investors didn't care about the food. They cared about the fact that McDonald's had this incredible real estate, national real estate empire.
Wow. Well, so how good did it get? How rich did they get? How many fortunes did they have? What was life like for Ray and Joan then?
There were lots of people who, in the orbit of McDonald's, who made tons of money just because the McDonald's were doing well. But Ray himself became an instant multimillionaire because he had the majority stock in McDonald's, but so did his secretary, who had 10% of the stock. He'd been very generous with her. And Harry Sonneborn, the guy with the real estate formula, had 20% of the stock. So millions and millions of dollars in 1965. And by then, Ray had divorced his first wife, married his second wife. He wasn't yet married to Joan. It wasn't until 69 that he married Joan, and she stepped into a life of fabulous wealth, moved on to Lakeshore Drive. They bought a fabulous condo and a historic building there, chauffeurs, jewels, all that. But that wasn't enough to keep her interested, and that's where the story, I think, gets even more interesting, because I find her story and how she gave the money away almost as interesting or more interesting than how it was made.
How so? Give me an example.
Well, you know, she wasn't the stuffy person sitting in the boardroom. She would react to things on television. I mean, the first and most pointed philanthropic exercise for Joan was reacting to Ray's drinking by starting Operation Cork, which was an alcoholism education charity geared toward the family. And she invented, she commissioned films and books and public service announcements from the best in the business very inventively, the same way McDonald's deployed commercials to sell burgers. She deployed media, and she was the mastermind behind it all, in the service of getting people to understand drinking and how terrible a disease it was for a family at a time in the 70s when people didn't talk about that sort of stuff. But then from there, she was so inventive. She would hear a news story and be so devastated by the turn of events in society that she'd seen depicted on the news that she'd fly someone in on her private jet to give a big check to whomever was suffering or to whatever cause it was that she wanted to support. Most interestingly, I think, is that Grand Forks flood years ago, 97, in North Dakota. She saw the mayor on TV every night, just, you know, making it happen for the people who were suffering, and Joan couldn't stand it, so she sent someone in on her plane with a check for $20 million. And I just love that about her, that she wasn't just, you know, a stuffy foundation. She reacted and made it happen.
Before we go, did she leave much money to her kids?
She only had one kid. Ray had a kid who had died of alcoholism earlier. So, and that one daughter of Joan's had four daughters herself. And she left them a slice of money, but most of it was gone. Most of her fortune, when she was diagnosed with cancer in 2003, she dispersed to all sorts of fabulous places that you can read about on my website, rayandjoan.com.
Or look at the appendix in the back of the book. I'll just close with this. So in 2003, the gifts announced posthumously, and I can't read them all, but they are in the tens of millions of dollars, and one of them, to my Salvation Army, $1.5 billion, upon which the Kroc Foundation set up those Kroc Centers, one of the greatest of which is on the far south side of Chicago. And I've always been, and I know a lot of people are very grateful to her and them for that. And that's just a few pages in the appendix at the end of Lisa Napoli's Ray and Joan. By the way, you're going to be in the area in the Hyde Park Public Library February 8th. I said Hyde Park. It's Highland Park. Highland Park Public Library. On February 8th, so sign them and sell them and read them there. And let's visit another day, Lisa. It's nice to talk to you. Well done.
You're terrific. Thank you so much.
Lisa Napoli, and the news is next. Thank you, Bob. It's 2:38. This is WGN Radio. I'm John Williams. The boys from the beat will say hello, and we'll preview their sports show. I don't know if they're going to talk much more about what I'm about to bring up. Normally, at this point, we do our Vibe Score segment. We're going to put that on hold today because today was a very unusual day. And maybe for some of you still is, these rallies that have cropped up around the world. I'm not exactly sure why people in Sydney feel like they need to rally about the election, but they are. And obviously they did in Washington, D.C. Maybe as many people in Chicago rallying today as any other city in America except the nation's capital. But in St. Paul, in Los Angeles, in Cleveland, in Pittsburgh, in Denver, all of the big cities and some of the smaller ones too, millions of people took to the street today. And I'm asking you this question, is that terrific, that's democracy, or it's a celebration, or it's a message to the administration that we're watching you, or is this just whiners who lost and they should not be doing this? Is this a good thing or not, is my question for you. But I'll just tell you out of the gate, I'm just surprised by it. So often, like when there's a Black Lives Matter rally or any kind of rally, they'll march and the police will be there, but the crowd is never as big as you think. They almost always overrepresent. In this case, it looks like they underrepresented. The thing just kept growing and growing. My suspicion is that Donald Trump's speech did a lot to make the crowds get bigger. But for whatever reason, people did show up, some wearing pink hats, some not. My number is 312-981-7200. We've got friends and reporters in Chicago and the Twin Cities and Washington, D.C., and the crowds have been big enough. We've actually had trouble getting cell service in and out to them. So if Andrea Darlis can join us shortly, we'll put her on. But it's been difficult today, and that's just from down the street. Mike has called in, and you're on WGN. Hey, Mike, it's John Williams. What's your thought on this?
How you doing, John?
Good.
First off, as someone who voted for Hillary, seeing these rallies and, you know, the, I don't know if you would call it cathartic because essentially this is the beginning of the journey, but still seeing these outbursts or the demonstrations, it makes me kind of frustrated because it does appear like you're whining because this passion didn't express itself on the first Tuesday of November. You would have thought there would have been, you know, record turnout among African-Americans, Hispanics, and women in favor of Hillary, if you're based on, you know, based on what you're seeing now after Trump has been elected and, you know, inaugurated. I didn't see this passion leading up, at least from the left, leading up to the election. I felt like it was apathy or at least indifference towards your nominee. But now that you lost, now you just, you know, you're expressing yourself passionately. Maybe I'm just reading it differently, but to me, I didn't see this passion leading up to the election from the left nearly as much as I'm seeing it after you lost. So it kind of appears like you're whining or you're a sore loser when you didn't have this passion leading up to it. But maybe that's just my read on it.
That's why I asked, Mike. I'll let you go. Thanks for the phone call. I don't see it as whining or being a bad sport, but you're absolutely right in the first point. Where was this passion? If there was this kind of support, then Hillary would have been elected. But remember that this isn't, I don't see this as a pro-Hillary rally. I don't see this as a pro-Hillary rally at all, although probably a lot of people out there wished that she had won. But I see it as more, I'm worried about what's about to happen to this country now that Donald Trump is the president. Okay, Sue, you're next. I think you're on WGN. Hi,
Hi Sue. Hi, King John. Hi, John.
Hey.
It's wonderful to hear your voice as usual. Anyway, I didn't know. I am embarrassed, whatever, to admit. I didn't know that much about what the Women's March was about. And I watched a good amount of it this morning and a little bit this afternoon in Washington. And I just felt that it was very, very empowering what a lot of the different speakers had to say, both the men and the women. And in the end, I can only speak for myself, of course, but it basically means nothing for a person individually unless, like one of the speakers, and I'm sure many others of them said, when you go back, well, I'm here, but if you go back to your home or you are living in the place you're living, I find it very empowering, and to me, a lot of things in life are momentum. And if this really inspires you to do good in your community or good for better in your life or volunteering or your job or your family, your friends.
That was Barack Obama's message too, wasn't it, as he left. He said, don't just sit there, get a clipboard, get involved. If you're not happy with what's about to happen, then you need to be the agent of change.
Exactly. Thank you so much, John.
Hey, bless you. Thank you for the phone call. Okay, Andrea Darlis is at Grant Park still. And Andrea, if you don't mind, I'll put you on maybe with a couple of our other listeners. You could give some perspective and insight. Are you there, Andrea?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm here, John. I'm still in Grant Park. I'm right at the exit/entrance to where this rally took place, just about a half a block away from the stage. And people are still continuing to file out here. And again, as we said before, John, so peaceful today, just so calm. It was the sunshine.
Maybe I shouldn't bring this up then, but I was dialing around online today, Andrea, just to see how these rallies across the country were going and how they're being reported. And on Drudge Report's website, they have a picture of a woman giving a finger to a Trump sign, and the headline is "Rallies Turn Nasty." And one woman did that, obviously. They've got a picture of it. But I haven't seen that many characterizations of these as being hostile. Would you say it was generally positive?
Oh, my gosh. And that's the thing. It really was positive. I mean, of course you have your dump Trump signs. And, you know, the interesting thing about this rally today, John, was that it really represented a lot of different people. There was Black Lives Matter. There were women's groups here. There were some ethnic groups. There was the Muslim American Society of Chicago. There was many, many gay rights groups. You know, this was a whole plethora of people just coming out to support each other. You know, there was no malice here. There was no let's destroy, let's, you know, swear and anything of that sort. You know, it was all positive. And, of course, the main message was female empowerment. So you had a lot of girl power signs. But on the positive side of that, too, you saw families, grandmothers with their granddaughters and their daughters, and they made it a day-long event. There was one group I talked to who actually drove up from Peoria, and they were wonderful. It was just, again, just everything I saw was positive and calm and peaceful.
I'm going to ask Krista for a hand here. So, Krista, if you could keep Andrea on with us now, and let's pick up a couple of phone lines. We'll go to Kim next. Hey, Kim, you're on WGN.
Hi. I have no problem with peaceful things like this, but I think what bothers me is the double standard. When Obama was elected, and if you didn't agree with what his policies or his things, you were called a racist. And so it really bothers me, this double standard that people have.
I'm not going to get into that with you, but I mean, because I really can't. I'm not exactly sure how to compare that statement with what happened today. But what do you think about today? Do you feel like
I'm fine with people. You know, that's the freedom of this country. My son served in the military.
But when you tried to if you wanted to try and do that four or 8 years ago,
you would have been labeled a racist. And not that you are, just you have a difference of opinion. You have I didn't agree with all of Obama's policies. And people should be able to talk about it peacefully and stuff like that. But
that's nice of you to call, Kim. I appreciate you listening, and I appreciate your call. I really do. Lots of lines to get to here. Let's go to Gene next. You're on WGN. Hi, Gene. You're on the air.
Hi. I don't believe there was any there was an incredible amount of backlash at the fact that Obama was elected. The things that were said were absolutely ridiculous and awful. And now they want us to be supportive of Trump. And I told them we will give them the same respect and credibility that they gave Obama. So I still haven't gotten over it. I think that the march is a wonderful thing, because overnight it turns out we do need to let him know that we are watching. He did away with a proclamation, some kind of a bill that Obama had set that was to go into effect on January 27th to lower the
mortgage
rates. Payments from the mortgage payments.
Yeah, yeah.
And also they've taken off on the White House page, it's missing the protection for the LGBT community. That was one of the first things he did, or they did.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. I was talking to some friends about that.
We have to be active.
Thank you for the call, Gene. I didn't understand that either. I don't think that was on anybody's radar. But for some people, first-time homeowners, their mortgage payments will go up maybe as much as $35 or $50 a month as a result of this executive order. Maybe there's a patch for that, but that's just one of the new things I'm reading today. Andrea, was there much agenda-driven stuff, like we need to fight House Bill number 8273 or call your congressman?
You know what, honestly? There was. You had so many different groups here. You had one women's rights group that was led by Dr. Lauren Stryker out of Northwestern. And, you know, this particular group was worried about their reproductive rights and what's going to happen. You know, again, this is way, way, way
down the line if this would ever happen, which I don't think it would. But, you know, they said, what if Roe v. Wade gets overturned because of the new Supreme Court justices? So that was their kind of rallying cry today. There was another group. It was a gay rights organization, and I interviewed a woman. She and her partner have been together 15 years. They have 5 children. And she's worried, you know, she was worried about, you know, gay rights, maybe gay marriage being overturned. You know, so every person here, I think, has had some sort of a concern or, you know, something that they were supporting. And then other people here were supporting them. So it was like, you know, friends of friends of friends supporting each other. You know, that's why, you know, that's why I say the overall message, at least on the surface and what we have been seeing and reporting, was positive. You know, it was, all right, you know what, this is what your cause is. You're doing it in a peaceful way, and you have others supporting you. And like I said before, you know, many made this a family event, which was really cool, too, because, you know, I talked to a 10-year-old girl, John, and she said, I can't wait to vote. I can't. And how cool is that? I mean, I remember at 10 years old, I don't even think I could say, I couldn't wait to vote. You know, so it's so neat that these kids are learning about the process and voting and getting involved.
Andrea Darlis is at Grant Park. Let's pause here for a minute. AD, if you got another minute, we'll take a couple more calls. You got a little more time to spend with us?
Absolutely. You bet.
All right. This is, we're about 10 minutes away from the top of the hour. The boys from the beat may or may not check in, but let's keep doing this on WGN. This is John Williams. It's almost 2:54 on WGN. Mark Carmen will say hi to us in just a minute, but let's talk to Andrea Darlis as we close up the show this afternoon. She spent, I guess, much of the day at Grant Park. Is that right, AD?
Yeah, we were here first thing in the morning for the setup, and then as soon as the rally started, we started filing some reports and following along, and we thought we'd be marching at one point, but then, of course, that they shut that down for good. You know, I think a lot of people initially thought, oh, the rally was canceled. No, but it was because there was too many people and just as a safety issue, and I think they might have done that in Washington, too. They were supposed to march further than they did, but what happened here, John, is that people started to march anyway. So they just kind of went in a big circle around the Art Institute and then came actually down south on Columbus and ended up here. And, yeah. Again, very peaceful.
When you saw the aerial shots, at least I did, you probably didn't, but of Chicago and Washington, D.C., you could see there was almost no room for them to march. All the space was taken. You know, like on some of the feeder streets and adjacent streets, I don't want to say it looked unorganized, but it just looked like more of a massive rally than a parade. And there just wasn't room, they felt, for people to safely move about. Andrea, Frank is on a phone line. We're going to take a last couple of calls here. Frank, thanks for calling. What did you want to say? You're on the air.
Hi, Sean. Hi, Andrea. My question is, aside from gay marriage, equality, and providing a transgender washroom for people, what are people afraid of with the Trump administration? Everybody has all this fear that something terrible or tragic is going to happen because Trump has taken office. Nobody has even given the gentleman an opportunity, and he's only been in office one full day.
Are you a Muslim?
No, sir, I'm not, but I'm not really sure why you would ask that.
Well, do you think a Muslim person would feel a little threatened by this administration?
In what regard?
Okay. I mean, I'm just asking you. I could name a bunch of small groups, each of who may feel a little threatened by Trump, and all of them for different reasons, maybe. If you were a Mexican-American,
well,
do you think you would feel a little threatened?
All these women that are marching, what happened back in the day when Clinton had all these accusations with other women, and he had to pay off all these women to be quiet? And he took advantage of a 22-year-old girl back in the day, and nobody ever marched about women's rights back in the day.
Frank, thanks for the phone call. I'll let Andrea respond to this.
I don't even know how to touch that one. I was going to say, well, I think many of the women here would ask, you know, if that caller was a woman. But, you know, when you asked if he was Muslim, that touche, it was a great question, you know. People are here marching, you know, and everybody I talked to and spoke with today, you know, they are worried. You know, their perception is there is a concern that their basic rights are going to be stripped of them. And they were marching, again, peacefully to say, hey, these are our rights, you know. This is their feeling. So I guess maybe in a roundabout way that answered his question, you know, people who feel threatened or who have been threatened that is perhaps why they were here today, saying, hey, you know what, I have a voice. I'm not going to have my basic rights taken away from me. And that's why they were here marching today.
However legitimate those fears are or not, Donald Trump can't do everything. But I also got the sense, Andrea, that it wasn't just one group, women. It was Hispanics. It was Muslims. It was blacks. It was gays. It was all of the people that feel a little threatened by this new administration came together at the same time. Is that kind of what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was really a great representation of everybody. There were straight people. There were gay people. There were men. There were women, black, white, Hispanic, Asian American. You know, there were so Muslims. There were so many people represented today, which I thought was kind of representative of America. You know, we are this big melting pot, and that's what everybody was coming together to say. You know, this is not just about one race or one class or one group. This is about everybody. And that's the message that they really, I think, got across today, John.
Time's up, Andrea. Boy, hey, you and I haven't visited in a while. It's nice to hear your voice. Thanks for helping me out today.
You too, my friend. Talk to you soon, John.
Stay well, and I was going to say warm, but it's been warm today. Okay, it's 2:58 on WGN. We'll see what's coming up on The Beat in a minute here on WGN Radio. Krista Flores is our engineer. Thank you for your help today, Krista. Andrea Darlis out in the field, obviously. You've heard her in Bob's reports. Our producer is Griffin Filipich. Griff does the vibe score with us, and we'll have to try and sneak that in next week. Hopefully the news won't be as large and calamitous. Speaking of large and calamitous, Carmen's here to tell us what's coming up on sports. Hey, Carm.
Hey, John. Kevin is here as well.
Hello, John.
And
hey,
we appreciate your coverage that you've been doing for the last however. I mean, I've been listening for about an hour now. So
yeah, what a day.
What a day. We're actually going to start with it. I know this is a sports show, but I feel like it's something that people want to talk about. So, and we're going to steal Andrea again. We want all Darlis all the time. Andrea's actually going to be on the show for the full 4 hours.
I don't know that she knows that, but if you guys continued more of this conversation, I know there's a lot of interest out there. People got a few things to say, so I'll get out of your way, and you guys keep going.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John. Have a great Saturday. This is Chicago's very own Chicago 720 WGN.